And the mother's offer still stands?
I suppose so.
And you're sitting here drinking Spanish brandy, when you could be off in the resort of your choice, losing your teacher integrity? After 15 years in 4 different high schools, McKee, Fashion Industry, Sewer Park, Stuyvesant, and a college in Brooklyn, I'm developing the instincts of a dog. When new classes come in September and February, I can sniff their chemical composition. I watch the way they look, and they watch the way I look. I can pick out types, the eager, willing ones, the cool, the show-me, the indifferent, the hostile. The opportunists here because they've heard I'm an easy marker. The lovers here simply to be near the beloved. In this school, you have to get their attention, challenge them. There they sit, row after row, bright, intelligent faces looking up at me, expectant, ready to let me prove myself. Before Stuyvesant, I was more taskmaster than teacher. I wasted class time in routine and discipline, telling them to take their seats, open their notebooks, fielding requests for the pass, dealing with their complaints. Now there was no more rowdy behavior. No more complaints about pushing or being pushed. No sandwiches in flight. No excuses for not teaching. If you don't perform, you'll lose their respect. Busy work is an insult. They know when you're blathering or killing time. Broadway audiences meet actors halfway with politeness and applause. They've paid high prices for their tickets. They cluster at stage doors and ask for autographs. Public high school teachers perform 5 times a day. Their audiences disappear when bells ring, and they're asked for autographs only on yearbooks at graduation. You can fool some of the kids some of the time, but they know when you're wearing the mask, and you know they know. They force you into truth. If you contradict yourself, they'll call out, "Hey, that's not what you said last week." You face years of experience and their collective truth. And if you insist on hiding behind the teacher mask, you lose them. Even if they lie to themselves and the world, they look for honesty in the teacher. At Stuyvesant, I decided to admit it when I didn't have answers. "I just don't know, friends. No, I've never read The Venerable Bede. I'm hazy on transcendentalism. John Donne and Gerard Manley Hopkins can be tough going. I'm weak on the Louisiana Purchase. I've glanced at Schopenhauer and fallen asleep over Kant. Don't even mention mathematics. I used to know the meaning of condign, but now it escapes me. I'm strong on usufruct. I'm sorry I couldn't finish The Fairy Queen. I'll try again someday after I sort out the metaphysicals." I won't use ignorance as an excuse. I won't take refuge behind the gaps in my education. I will lay out a program of self-improvement to make me a better teacher. Disciplined, traditional, scholarly, resourceful, ready with answers. I'll dip into history, art, philosophy, archaeology. I'll sweep through the pageant of English language and literature from the Angles and Saxons and Jutes to the Normans, the Elizabethans, the neoclassicists, the Romantics, the Victorians, the Edwardians, the war poets, the structuralists, the modernists, the postmodernists. I'll take an idea and trace its history from a cave in France to that room in Philadelphia where Franklin and the rest hammered out the Constitution of the USA. I'll show off a bit, I suppose, and they might be sneering, but who can begrudge the ill-paid teacher a moment to prove a little learning is a dangerous thing? The students never stopped trying to divert me from traditional English, but I was onto their tricks. I still told stories, but I was learning how to connect them with the likes of the Wife of Bath, Tom Sawyer, Holden Caulfield, Romeo, and his reincarnation in West Side Story. English teachers are always being told, "You gotta make it relevant." I was finding my voice and my own style of teaching. I was learning to be comfortable in the classroom. Like Roger Goodman, my new chairman, Bill Ince, gave me free rein to try out ideas about writing and literature, to create my own classroom atmosphere, to do whatever I liked without bureaucratic interference. And my students were mature and tolerant enough to let me find my own way without the help of the mask or the red pen. There are two basic ways of capturing the attention of the American teenager. Sex and food. You have to be careful with sex. Word goes back to the parents, and you're called on the carpet to explain why you're allowing your writing students to read stories about sex. You point out that it was done in good taste, in the spirit of romance rather than biology. That is not enough. Kenny DeFalco called from the back of the room to ask if I'd like a marzipan. He held up something white and said he'd made it himself. I told him in my proper teacher way it was against the rules to eat or drink in class, and what was marzipan anyway? Taste it, he said. It was delicious. There was a chorus of requests for marzipans, but Kenny said he'd run out of them. Tomorrow he'd bring in 36 marzipans, which of course he'd make himself. Then Tommy Esposito said he'd bring various bits and pieces from his father's restaurant. They might be leftovers, but he'd make sure they were nice and hot. That started a chorus of offers. A Korean girl said she'd bring in something her mother made, kimchi, a hot cabbage that could take the roof off your mouth. Kenny said if all this food was coming in, we should forget class, meet tomorrow in Stuyvesant Square next door and lay everything out in the grass. He said also we should remember to bring plastic utensils and napkins. Tommy said no, he'd never eat his father's meatballs with plastic. He was willing to bring in 36 forks, didn't mind one bit if we used them for other dishes. He suggested also Mr. McCourt be excused from bringing anything. It's hard enough teaching kids without having to feed them too. Next day, people walking in the park stopped to see what we were doing. A doctor from Beth Israel Hospital said he'd never seen such an array of food. When he was offered bits and sips, he rolled his eyes and hummed with pleasure, till he tasted the kimchi and had to beg for a cold drink for his burnt palate. Instead of laying the dishes out in the grass, we spread them along park benches. There were Jewish dishes, kreplak, matzahs, gefilte fish, Italian, lasagna, Tommy's meatballs, ravioli, risotto, Chinese, Korean, a huge 36-person meatloaf made with beef, veal, potatoes, onions. A police car cruised by. The cops wanted to know what was going on. You're not supposed to have fairs in the park without city permission. I explained this was a lesson in vocabulary, and look at what my students were learning. The cops said they'd never had a vocabulary lesson like this in Catholic school. Everything looked delicious, and I said they should step out of the car and try something. When the Beth Israel doctor warned them to watch out for the kimchi, they said, bring it on. There wasn't a hot food in Vietnam and Thailand they hadn't tried. They spooned it in and yelped and called for something cold. Before they drove away, they asked how often we planned to have these vocabulary lessons. The homeless shuffled and edged their way into the group, and we gave them the little that was left over. One spat out a marzipan, saying, what kind of crap is this? I might be homeless, but you don't have to insult me. I stood on a park bench to announce my new idea. I had to compete with student chatter, the mumbling and complaining of the homeless, the remarks of the curious public, the hoot and honk of Second Avenue traffic. Listen, are you listening? Tomorrow I'd like you to bring to class a cookbook. Yes, a cookbook. What? You don't have a cookbook? Well then, I'd like to plan a visit to the family that doesn't own a cookbook. We'll take up a collection for you. Don't forget, tomorrow, the cookbook. Mr. McCord, why do we have to bring cookbooks? I don't know yet. Maybe I'll know tomorrow. There's something in my head which might become an idea. Mr. McCord, don't get mad, but sometimes you're like weird. They brought the cookbooks. They said, what does this have to do with learning how to write? You'll see. Open your book to any page. If you've already been through the book and have a favorite recipe, open to that. David, read yours. What? Read your recipe. Out loud, right here in class? Yes, come on, David, it's not pornography. We don't have all day. We have to get through dozens of recipes. But Mr. McCourt, I never read a recipe in my life. I never read a cookbook in my life. I never even cooked an egg. Good, David. Today your palate comes to life. Today your vocabulary expands. Today you become a gourmet. A hand. What's a gourmet? Another hand. A gourmet is a person who appreciates good food and wine and the finer things in life. A chorus of oohs travels around the room, and there are smiles and admiring glances for James, who is the last one you'd ever expect to know anything beyond hot dogs and French fries. David reads a recipe for coq au vin. His voice is flat and tentative, but his interest seems to grow as he goes through the recipe, discovering ingredients he's never heard of. David, I want you and the class to note the time and date and the fact that in room 205 of Stuyvesant High School, you recited to your peers the first recipe of your life. Only God knows where this will lead you. I want all of you to remember that this is probably the first time in history a class in creative writing or English sat together and read cookbook recipes. David, you will notice the absence of wild applause. You read that recipe as if you were reading a page of the New York telephone directory, but don't despair. You were in virgin territory, and when we return for your next reading, I'm sure you'll give the recipe full value. Anyone else? There's a forest of hands. I call on Brian. I know it's a mistake, and I know the negative comment is coming. He's another little twerp like Andrew of the tilted chair, but I'm the teacher rising above it, mature and ready to put my ego aside. Yes, Brian? He looks at Penny in the seat beside him. He's gay, she's lesbian, they don't hide it. They never knew a closet. He's short and fat, she's tall and thin, and she holds her head as if to say, you want to make something of it? I don't want to make something of it. Why have they joined forces against me? I know they dislike me, and why can't I accept that simple fact? You can't be liked by every one of the hundreds of kids you have every year. There are teachers like Phil Fisher who don't give a damn about being liked or disliked. He'd say, I'm teaching calculus, you hopeless blockheads. If you don't pay attention, if you don't study, you'll fail, and if you fail, you'll wind up teaching arithmetic to schizophrenics. If all the kids in the class despise him, Phil would despise them in turn and pound advanced calculus into their heads till they could recite it in their sleep. Yes, Brian? Oh, he's a cool one, this Brian. There's another little smile for Penny. He's going to turn me into shish kebab. He takes his time. I don't know, Mr. McCourt. How could I go home and tell my parents we're sitting around in a junior class of Stuyvesant High School reading recipes from cookbooks? Other classes are reading American literature. But we have to sit here reading recipes like we were retards. I feel irritated. I'd like to demolish Brian with a cutting remark, but James, of the gourmet definition, takes charge. Could I say something? He looks at Brian. All you ever do is sit there criticizing. Tell me this. Are you glued to your seat? Of course I'm not glued to my seat. Do you know where the program office is? Yeah. So, if you don't like what we do here, why don't you get your ass off that chair and go to the program office and change your class? Nobody's keeping you here, right, Mr. McCourt? Transfer, says James. Get out of here. Go read Moby Dick if you're strong enough. Susan Gilman never raises her hand. Everything is too urgent. No use telling her calling out is against the rules. She brushes that aside. Who cares? She wants you to know she's discovered your game. I know why you want us to read these recipes out loud like this. You do? Because they look like poetry on the page, and some of them read like poetry. I mean, they're even better than poetry because you can taste them. And wow, the Italian recipes are pure music. Maureen McSherry chimes in. The other thing I like about the recipes is you can read them the way they are without pain-in-the-ass English teachers digging for the deeper meaning. All right, Maureen, we'll get back to that sometime. What? The pain-in-the-ass English teachers digging for meaning. Michael Carr says he has his flute with him, and if anyone would like to recite or sing a recipe, he'll play with them. Brian looks skeptical. He says, are you kidding? Play your flute with a recipe? Are we going crazy in this class? Susan tells him can it, and offers to read a recipe for lasagna with Michael backing her up. While she reads a recipe for Swedish meatballs, he plays Hava Nagila, a melody that has nothing to do with Swedish meatballs, and the class goes from giggling to serious listening to applause and congratulations. James says they should take it on the road and call themselves the Meatballs or the Recipes, and offers to be their agent as he's going into accounting. When Maureen reads a recipe for Irish soda bread, Michael plays the Irish washerwoman to a tapping and a clacking around the room. The class is alive. They tell one another this is wild. The very idea of reading recipes, reciting recipes, singing recipes, with Michael adjusting his flute to French, English, Spanish, Jewish, Irish, Chinese recipes. What if someone walked in? Those Japanese educators who come and stand at the back of the room and watch teachers teach? How would the principal explain Susan and Michael and the meatball concerto? Brian casts a damper on the proceedings. He asks if he can have a pass to the program office to see if he can get a transfer on account of how he's learning nothing in this class. I mean, if the taxpayers heard how we were wasting our high school years chanting recipes, you'd be out of a job, Mr. McCourt. Nothing personal, he says. He turns to Penny for support, but she's rehearsing a paella recipe from another student's cookbook. She shakes her head at Brian, and when she's finished with the recipe, tells him if he leaves this class, he's crazy. Crazy. Her mother has a recipe for lamb stew that is out of this world, and when Penny brings it in tomorrow, she'd like Michael to be prepared with his flute. Oh, if she could bring her mother to class. Her mother always sings when she makes that lamb stew in the kitchen. And wouldn't it be something if Penny could just read out that recipe with her mother singing and Michael playing that beautiful flute? Wouldn't that be something? Brian blushes and says he plays the oboe and would love to play with Michael when Penny does her lamb stew recipe tomorrow. She puts her hand on his arm and says, yeah, we'll do it tomorrow. On the A train to Brooklyn, I feel uneasy over the direction this class is taking, especially since my other classes are asking why can't they go to the park with all kinds of food, and why can't they have recipe readings with music? How can all this be justified to the authorities who keep an eye on the curriculum? Mr. McCourt, what the hell is going on in this room? You've got these kids reading cookbooks, for Christ's sakes, and singing recipes. Are you kidding us? Could you kindly explain what this has to do with the teaching of English? Where are your lessons on literature, English or American or anything else? These kids, as you know very well, are preparing for the best colleges in the country, and is this how you want to send them into the world? Reading recipes, chanting recipes, singing recipes? How about choreographing Irish stew or the classic Western omelette with appropriate music, of course? Why not forget English and college preparation altogether and turn the classroom into a kitchen with demonstration lessons on cooking? Why don't we create a Stuyvesant High School recipe chorus and give concerts around town and internationally to benefit these kids who wasted their time in your class, McCourt, and didn't get into college and now flip flour and pizza joints or wash dishes in second-rate French bistros uptown? That's what it's going to come to. These kids might be able to sing a recipe for pâté de something or other, but they'll never sit in Ivy League classrooms. It's too late. I can't walk in tomorrow and tell them it's all over. Forget the cookbooks. No more recipes. Put your flute away, Michael. Silence your mother, Penny. Sorry about the oboe, Brian. Except for Brian's little moment of rebellion, hadn't we had 3 days of complete class participation? And most of all, teacher man, didn't you enjoy yourself? Or were you just a bloody fool, allowing yourself once again to be diverted from Mark Twain and F. Scott Fitzgerald in junior classes, and Wordsworth and Coleridge in senior classes? Shouldn't you insist they bring textbooks daily so they can go a-dipping and a-hunting for deeper meanings? Yes, yes, but not now, not now. Are the kids on to you? Playing you along with the recipes and the music? Mea culpa time? Are you, under it all, a fraud, playing along with the way they're playing you along? You can imagine what they're saying in the teacher's lounge. The Irishman has his classes completely duped. All they do is, man, you won't believe this, all they do is read cookbooks. Yeah, Forget Milton and Swift and Hawthorne and Melville. For Christ's sakes, they're reading The Joy of Cooking and Fanny Farmer and Betty Crocker and singing recipes. Jesus! You can hardly hear yourself down the hall with the din of oboes and flutes and chanted recipes coming from his goddamn room. Who does he think he's fooling? Maybe you could find a way of enjoying yourself less. You're always ingenious in making yourself miserable and you don't want to lose the touch. Maybe you could try again to teach diagramming or grub for deeper meanings. You could inflict Beowulf and the Chronicles on your suffering adolescence. What about your grand program of self-improvement, Mr. Polymath? Look at your life outside the school. You belong nowhere, periphery man. You have no wife and a child you rarely see. No vision, no plan, no goal. Just amble to the crypt, man. Fade and leave no legacy but memories of a man who turned his classroom into a playground, a rap session, and a group therapy forum. Why not? What the hell? What are schools for anyway? I ask you, is it the task of the teacher to supply cannon fodder for the military-industrial complex? Are we shaping packages for the corporate assembly line? Oh, aren't we getting solemn? And where did I leave my soapbox? Look at me, wandering late bloomer, floundering old fart, discovering in my 40s what my students knew in their teens. Let there be no caterwauling. Sing no sad songs for me, no weeping at the bar. I am called before the court, accused of leading a double life, to wit, that in the classroom I enjoy myself and deny my students a proper education, while I toss nightly on my celibate cot and wonder, God help us, what's it all about? I must congratulate myself in passing for never having lost the ability to examine my conscience. Never having lost the gift of finding myself wanting and defective. Why fear the criticism of others when you yourself are first out of the critical gates? If self-denigration is the race, I am the winner, even before the starting gun. Collect the bets. Fear. That's it, Francis. The little slum boy still fears loss of job. Fears he'll be cast into the outer darkness and deafened by the weeping, the wailing, the gnashing. Brave, imaginative teacher encourages teenagers to sing recipes, but wonders when the axe will fall, when Japanese visitors will shake their heads and report him to Washington. Japanese visitors will instantly detect in my classroom signs of America's degeneracy and wonder how they could have lost the war. And if the axe falls, a pox on the axe. Friday, the agenda was packed. In the room, four guitarists plucked at strings. The new cooperative Brian practiced his oboe. Michael trilled on his flute. Zach rapped out culinary themes on the small bongo drums between his knees. Two boys played harmonicas. Susan Gilman stood ready to monopolize the period with a recipe that ran for multiple columns, required 47 different steps, and called for ingredients not seen in the average American household. She said it was pure poetry, and Michael was so excited, he was ready to compose a piece for woodwind, strings, bongo drums, and Susan's voice. Pam is going to do a Peking duck recipe in Cantonese, and her brother from another class is playing this strange-looking instrument no one in this class ever saw before. I tried to inject a little teaching. I say, if you're an observant writer, you'll recognize the significance of this event. For the first time in history, a Chinese recipe is to be read with background music. You have to be alert to historic moments. The writer is always saying, what's going on here? Always, you can bet your last dime that nowhere in history, Chinese or otherwise, will you find a moment like this. I attend to the historic event. Write the items on the blackboard. We'll start with Pam and her duck. Then Leslie with English trifle, Larry with Eggs Benedict, Vicky with stuffed pork chops. Guitars, oboes, flutes, harmonicas, bongo drums are warming up. Readers are silently rehearsing recipes. Shy Pam nods to her brother, and the Peking duck recital begins. It's a long recipe, with Pam singing in a high wail and her brother plucking the strings of his instrument, so long a recipe that the other musicians began to join in one at a time, and by the time Pam has finished reading, the instruments are in full ensemble, challenging Pam to octave so high and rhythm so urgent that Assistant Principal Murray Kahn rushes from his office fearing the worst, and when he looks through the window and sees this performance in progress, he can't resist coming in, his eyes wider than wide, till Pam's voice grows softer and softer, the musicians fade, and the duck is done. At the end, class critics suggested Pam should have performed last. They said her duck recipe and the Chinese music were so dramatic everything else sounded anemic. Also, they said words and music were often mismatched. It was a big mistake using bongo drums to back English trifle. You need the delicacy and sensitivity of the violin, or maybe the harpsichord, and it really puzzled them that anyone would link bongos and English trifle. And speaking of violins, Michael was just perfect backing the Eggs Benedict reading, and they really dug the bongo and harmonica combination for stuffed pork chops. There was something about pork chops that demanded the harmonica, and it was amazing now how you could think of a food and an instrument to go with it. Man! This experience called for a new kind of thinking. They said kids in other classes wished they could read recipes instead of Alfred Lord Tennyson and Thomas Carlyle. Other English teachers were teaching solid stuff, analyzing poetry, assigning research papers, and giving lessons on the correct use of footnotes and bibliography. Thinking of those other English teachers and the solid stuff makes me uneasy again. They're following the curriculum, preparing the kids for higher education and the great world beyond. We're not here to enjoy ourselves, teacher man. This is Stuyvesant High School, the jewel in the crown of the New York educational system. These kids are the brightest of the bright, and in a year they'll be sitting at the feet of distinguished professors at the best universities in the country. They'll be taking notes, copying words that will require looking up. No farting around with cookbooks and visits to the park. There will be direction and focus and serious scholarship. And whatever became of that teacher we had back in Stuyvesant, you know the one. On Monday, I'll make the announcement. There will be groans and muted catcalls and whispered comments about my mother. But I have to get back on track like all those other conscientious teachers. I will remind my students that the mission of this school is to prepare them for the best colleges and universities so that they can graduate someday and make solid contributions to the welfare and progress of this country. For if this country falters and fails, what hope is there for the rest of the world? You bear a heavy responsibility as you go forth, and it would be criminal of me, the teacher, to waste your young lives with the reading of recipes, no matter how much you enjoy the activity. I know we're all having a good time reading recipes with background music, but that is not why we were put on earth. We have to move on. That is the American way. Mr. McCourt, why shouldn't we read recipes? Isn't a recipe for meatloaf as important as these poems that no one can understand anyway, isn't it? You can live without poetry, but you can't live without food. I tried to balance Walt Whitman and Robert Frost with meatloaf and recipes in general, but rambled into a mumble. They groan again when I announce I am going to recite my favorite poem. That pisses me off, and I tell them, "You are pissing me off." A shocked silence. Teacher using bad language. Never mind. Recite the poem. Little Bo Peep has lost her sheep and doesn't know where to find them. Leave them alone, and they will come home, wagging their tails behind them. Hey, what's going on here? That's not a poem. This is high school, and he's giving us Mother Goose. Is he pulling our leg, playing little games with us? I recite the poem again, and encourage them to waste no time in digging for the deeper meaning. Oh, come on, is this a joke? Man, this is high school. On the surface, the poem or nursery rhyme seems simple. A plain story of a little girl who has lost her sheep, but are you listening? This is significant. She has learned to leave them alone. Bo Peep is cool. She trusts her sheep. She doesn't go bothering them as they nibble away in pasture, glen, vale, and hillside. They need their grass, their roughage, and the occasional draught of water from a tinkling mountain stream. Also, they have little lambs who need time for bonding with their mothers after they've frolicked all day with their peers. They don't need the world barging in and destroying the mood. They might be sheep, they might be lambs, they might be ewes, they might be rams, but they're entitled to a little communal happiness before they're transformed into the mutton we devour, the wool we wear. Oh, God, Mr. McCourt, did you have to end it like that? Why couldn't you just leave them out there, sheep and lambs, all loving and enjoying themselves? We eat them, we wear them, it's not right. There are vegetarians and vegans in this class who, thank God, right here and now, they have nothing to do with exploiting these poor animals, and could we get back to Bo Peep? They'd like to know if I am trying to make some kind of point. No, I'm not trying to make some kind of point, except to say I like this poem because of its simple message. What's that? That people should stop bothering people. Little Bo Peep backs off. She could stay up all night waiting and whimpering by the door, but she knows better. She trusts her sheep. She leaves them alone and they come home. And you can imagine the joyful reunion. A lot of merry bleating and frolicking and deep expressions of satisfaction from the rams as they settle in for the night, while Bo Peep knits by the fire, happy in the knowledge that in her daily rounds, caring for the sheep and their offspring, she has bothered nobody. In my English classes at Stuyvesant High School, the students agreed that nothing on television or out of Hollywood could equal in violence and horror the story of Hansel and Gretel. Jonathan Greenberg spoke out, "How can we subject children to the story of some asshole of a father who's so dominated by his new wife he's willing to lose his kids in the woods and let them starve to death? How can we tell children how Hansel and Gretel were locked up by that witch who wanted to fatten and cook them? And is there anything more horrible than the scene where they push her into the fire? She's a mean old cannibal of a witch and deserves what she got, but wouldn't all this give a kid nightmares?" Lisa Berg said these stories have been around for hundreds of years. "We grew up with them and enjoy them and survive them, so what's the big deal?" Rose Kane agreed with Jonathan. When she was little, she had nightmares over Hansel and Gretel, and maybe that was because she herself had a new stepmother who was a bitch on wheels. A real bitch who wouldn't think twice of losing her and her sister in Central Park or some distant station in the New York subway system. After she heard the Hansel and Gretel story from her first grade teacher, she refused to go anywhere with her stepmother unless her father was with them. That would infuriate her father so much, he'd threaten her with all kinds of punishment. "You go with your stepmother, Rose, or you're grounded forever." Which, of course, proved he was completely dominated by the stepmother, who had a carbuncle on her chin like all the stepmothers in fairy tales, a carbuncle with little sprouting hairs that she was always plucking. Everyone in the class seemed to have an opinion on the Hansel and Gretel story, and the main question was, would you tell this story to your children? I suggested that the pros and the antis separate and sit on opposite sides of the room, and it was remarkable to see that the class was split down the middle. I suggested also that there should be a moderator for this discussion, but passions were running high. No one was neutral on the matter, and I'd have to take the job myself. It was minutes before I could calm the hullabaloo in the room. The anti-Hansel and Gretel side said their children would be damaged so badly it would lead to huge costs in psychotherapy. "All bullshit," said the pro side. "Come off it. No one is in therapy because of fairy tales. Every kid in Europe and America grew up with these stories." The antis brought up the violence in Little Red Riding Hood, the wolf swallowing the grandmother without even chewing her, and the meanness of the stepmother in Cinderella. You wonder how a kid could survive hearing or reading any of this. Lisa Berg said something so remarkable it caused a sudden silence in the room. She said kids have stuff in their heads so dark and deep it's beyond our comprehension. "Wow," someone said. They knew Lisa had hit on something. They weren't so far removed from childhood themselves, although they wouldn't like to hear you say it, and you could sense in that silence a drifting back to a childhood dreamland. Next day we sang fragments from my childhood. There was no point to the activity, no deeper meaning, no Tess loomed to infect our singing. I felt twinges of guilt, but I enjoyed myself. And from the way they sang, those Jewish, Korean, Chinese, American kids, I assumed they enjoyed themselves too. They knew the basic nursery rhymes. Now they had melodies to go with them. Oh, Mother Hubbard, Hubbard went to the cupboard, cupboard to get her doggy a bone. When she got there, there the cupboard was bare, bare, so the poor doggy got none. Observation report I would have written if I were Assistant Deputy Superintendent of Pedagogy at the Board of Education, 110 Livingston Street, Brooklyn, New York, 11201. Dear Mr. McCourt, when I entered your classroom on March 2nd, your students were singing rather loudly and disturbingly, I may say, a medley of nursery rhymes. You led them from rhyme to rhyme with no pauses for elucidation, exploration, justification, analysis. Indeed, there seemed to be no context at all for this activity, no purpose. A teacher of your experience might surely have noted the number of students attired in outerwear, the number lounging in their seats with legs stuck into the aisles. No one seemed to have a notebook nor instructions for its use. You realized the notebook is the basic tool of any high school student of English, and the teacher who neglects that tool is derelict in his or her duty. Regrettably, there was nothing on the chalkboard to indicate the nature of the day's lesson. That may explain why the notebooks lay unused in the students' bags. Within my rights as an assistant deputy superintendent of pedagogy, I queried some of your students when the session ended as to whatever learnings they might have carried away that day. They were vague to the point of head-scratching, completely at a loss as to the point of this singing activity. One said he had enjoyed himself, and that is a valid comment, but surely that is not the purpose of a high school education. I fear I will have to pass on my observations to the Deputy Superintendent of Pedagogy, who no doubt will inform the Superintendent of Pedagogy herself. You may be summoned for a hearing at the Board of Education. If so, you may be accompanied by a union representative and or a lawyer. Sincerely, Montague Wilkinson III. All right, the bell has rung. Once again, you are mine. Open your books, turn to this poem, My Papa's Waltz, by Theodore Rothke. If you don't have a book, look over someone's shoulder. No one in this class would begrudge you an over-the-shoulder look. Stanley, would you read the poem aloud? Thanks. My Papa's Waltz, by Theodore Rothke. The whiskey on your breath could make a small boy dizzy. But I hung on like death, such waltzing was not easy. We romped until the pans slid from the kitchen shelf. My mother's countenance could not unfrown itself. The hand that held my wrist was battered on one knuckle. At every step you missed, my right ear scraped a buckle. You beat time on my head with a palm caked by dirt, then waltzed me off to bed, still clinging to your shirt. Thanks again, Stanley. Take a few minutes to look over the poem again. Let it sink in. So, when you read the poem, what happened? What do you mean, what happened? You read the poem. Something happened. Something moved in your head, in your body, in your lunchbox. Or nothing happened. You're not required to respond to every stimulus in the universe. You're not weather vanes. Mr. McCourt, what are you talking about? I'm saying you don't have to respond to everything a teacher or anyone else sets before you. They look dubious. Oh, yeah? Tell that to some of the teachers around here. They take everything personally. Mr. McCourt, do you want us to talk about what the poem means? I'd like you to talk about whatever you'd like to talk about in the general neighborhood of this poem. Bring in your grandmother if you like. Don't worry about the real meaning of the poem. Even the poet won't know that. When you read it, something happened or nothing happened. Would you raise your hand if nothing happened? All right, no hands. So, something happened in your head, or your heart, or your bowels. You're a writer. What happens when you hear music, chamber music, rock? You see a couple arguing on the street. You look at a child rebelling against his mother. You see a homeless man begging. You see a politician giving a speech. You ask someone to go out with you. You observe the response of the other person. Because you're a writer, you ask yourself always, 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 what's happening, baby? Well, like, this poem is about a father dancing with his kid, and it's not pleasant because the father is drunk and insensitive. Bride? If it's not pleasant, why does he hang on like death? Monica? There's a lot going on here. The kid is dragged around the kitchen. He could be a rag doll for all the papa cares. Bride again? There's a giveaway word here. Romped. That's a happy word, right? I mean, he could have said danced or something ordinary, but he says romped, and like you're always telling us, a word can change the atmosphere of a sentence or a paragraph, so romped creates a happy atmosphere. Jonathan, you could tell me I'm out of order, Mr. McCorpy. Did your father ever dance you around the kitchen? He never danced us around the kitchen, but he got us out of bed late at night and made us sing patriotic Irish songs and promised to die for Ireland. Yeah, I figured this poem had something to do with your childhood. That's partly true, but I asked you to read this because it captures a moment, a mood, and there might be, forgive me for this, there might be a deeper meaning. Some of you want the worth of your money. What about the mother? Sheila? What's going on in this poem is very simple. This guy has a hard job, coal miner or something, comes home with a battered knuckle, hands caked with dirt. The wife sits over there, mad as hell, but she's used to it. She knows it's going to happen once a week when he gets paid. Like your dad, right, Mr. McCourt? The kid loves his father because you're always drawn to the crazy one. Doesn't matter that the mother keeps the house going. Kid takes that for granted. So, when the dad comes home, oh, he's all charged up from the drink and gets the kid all excited. What happens when the poem finishes, David? The dad waltzes him off to bed. The mom puts the pans back on the kitchen shelf. Next day is Sunday, and the dad gets up feeling lousy. The mom makes breakfast, but won't talk to anyone, and the kid is caught between. He's only about 9 because he's only tall enough to scrape his ear on the buckle. The mother would like to walk out and get a divorce because she's sick of the drinking and the lousy life, but she can't because she's stuck in the middle of West Virginia, and there's no escape when you don't have money. Jonathan, what I like about this poem is, there it is, a simple story. Oh no, wait a minute, it isn't that simple. There's a lot going on, and there's a before and after. If you were to make a movie out of this poem, you'd have a hard job directing it. Would you have the kid in the opening scene where the mother and the kid are waiting for the father? Or would you just show the opening lines where the kid is wincing over the whiskey? How would you tell the kid to hang on? Reaching up to hang on to the shirt? How would you get the mother's countenance without making her look mean? You'd have to decide what kind of guy this dad is when he's sober, because if he's like this all the time, you wouldn't even want to make a movie about him. What I don't like is how he beats time on the kid's head with a dirty hand, which, of course, is proof he works hard. Anne? I don't know. There's a lot in here after you talk about it. Why can't we just leave it alone? Just take the story and feel sorry for the kid and the mother with her countenance and maybe the dad, and not analyze it to death. David? We're not analyzing, we're just responding. If you go to a movie, you come out talking about it, don't you? Sometimes, but this is a poem, and you know what English teachers do to poems. Analyze, 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 dig for the deeper meaning. That's what turned me against poetry. Someone should dig a grave and bury the deeper meaning. I asked you only what happened when you read the poem. If nothing happened, it's not a crime. When I hear heavy metal, the eyes glaze. Some of you could probably explain it to me, and I try to listen to that music with some understanding, but I just don't care. You don't have to respond to every stimulus. If my papa's waltz leaves you cold, then it leaves you cold. That's one thing, Mr. McCorp, but we have to be careful. If you say something negative about anything, English teachers take it personally and get mad. My sister got in trouble with an English professor, Cornell, over the way she interpreted one of Shakespeare's sonnets. He said she was off the mark entirely, and she said a sonnet could be read 100 different ways. Otherwise, why would you see 1,000 Shakespeare criticism books on the library shelves? And he got pissed off and told her to see him in his office. This time he was nice to her, and she backed off, and said maybe he was right, and went out to dinner with him in Ithaca. And I got pissed off at her for giving in like that. Now we only say hello to each other. Why don't you write about that, Anne? It's an unusual story. You and your sister not talking because of a Shakespeare sonnet. I could, but I'd have to get into the whole sonnet thing, what he said, what she said. And since I hate getting into deeper meanings, and she's not talking to me anyway, I don't have the entire story. David, make it up. There are three characters here, Anne and her sister and the professor, and there's the sonnet that's causing all the trouble. You could have a hell of a time with that sonnet. You could change the names, get away from the sonnet, say it's a big fight about my papa's waltz, and the next thing is you have a story they want to turn into a movie. Jonathan? No offense to Anne, but I can't think of anything more boring than a story about a college student arguing with a professor over a sonnet. I mean, Jesus, excuse the language, this world is falling to pieces, people starving, etc., and these people have nothing else to do but argue over a poem. I'd never buy that story, and I wouldn't go to a movie if they let me take my whole family for free. Mr. McCourt? Yes, Anne. Tell Jonathan he can kiss my ass. Sorry, Anne. That's a message you'll have to deliver yourself. There's the bell, but remember, you don't have to respond to every stimulus. Whenever a lesson sagged, whenever their minds wandered, when too many asked for the pass, I fell back on the dinner interrogation. Government officials or concerned superiors might have asked, "Is this a valid educational activity?" Yes, it is, ladies and gentlemen, because this is a writing class and everything is grist to our mill. Also, the interrogation made me feel like a prosecutor playing with a witness. If the class was amused, I took credit. I was at center stage, master teacher, interrogator, puppeteer, conductor. James, what did you have for dinner last night? He looked surprised. What? Dinner, James. What did you have for dinner last night? He seems to be searching his memory. James, it's less than 24 hours ago. Oh yeah, chicken. Where did it come from? What do you mean? Did someone buy it, James, or did it fly in the window? My mother. So, your mother does the shopping? Well, yeah, except like sometimes we run out of milk or something, and she sends my sister to the store. My sister always complains. Does your mother work? Yeah, she's a legal secretary. How old is your sister? 14. And you? 16. So, your mother works and does the shopping, and your sister is 2 years younger than you and has to run to the store. You are never sent to the store. No. So, who cooks the chicken? My mother. And what are you doing while your sister runs to the store and your mother is knocking herself out in the kitchen? I'm like in my room. Doing what? Catching up with my homework or, you know, listening to music. And what is your father doing while your mother cooks the chicken? He's like in the living room, watching the news on TV. He has to keep up with things because he's a broker. Who helps your mother in the kitchen? Sometimes my sister helps. Not you, not your father. We don't know how to cook. But someone has to set the table. My sister. Haven't you ever set the table? Yeah, once when my sister went to the hospital with her appendix. But it was no good because I didn't know where to put things and my mom got mad and told me, get out of the kitchen. All right. Who puts the food on the table?
Mr. McCourt, I don't know why you keep asking me these questions when you know what I'm going to say. My mom puts the food on the table.
What did you have with the chicken last night?
We had, like, you know, salad.
What else?
We had baked potatoes, me and my dad. My mom and sister won't eat them because they're on a diet and the potato is a killer.
And what about the table setting? Did you have a tablecloth?
Are you kidding? We had straw placemats.
What happened during dinner?
What do you mean?
Did you talk? Was there fine music to dine by?
My dad kept listening to the TV, and my mom got mad at him for not paying attention to his dinner after all the trouble she went to.
Oh, conflict at the dinner table. Didn't you all discuss the events of the day? Didn't you talk about school?
Nah.
Then Mom started clearing the table because my dad went back to watch the TV. My mom got mad again because my sister said she didn't want her chicken. She said it was making her fat, the chicken. Mr. McCourt, why are we doing this? Why are you asking all these questions? It's so boring. Turn it back to the class. What do you think? This is a writing class. Did you learn anything about James and his family? Is there a story there? Jessica?
My mom would never put up with that crap. James and his dad get treated like kings. The mom and the sister do everything, and they just hang out and get the dinner served up to them. I'd like to know who cleans up and washes the dishes. No, I don't have to ask. The mom, the sister.
Hands are waving. All girls. I could see they want to attack James.
Wait, wait, ladies, before you zero in on James, I'd like to know if each of you is a paragon of virtue around the house, always helpful, always thoughtful. Before we go on, tell me this. How many of you, after eating last night, thanked your mother, kissed her, and complimented her on the dinner? Sheila?
Oh, that'd be phony. The mothers know we appreciate what they do.
A dissenting voice. No, they don't. If James thanked his mother, she'd faint. I played to the crowd till Daniel took the wind out of my sails.
Daniel, what did you have for dinner last night?
Veal medallions and a kind of white wine sauce.
What did you have with the veal medallions and white wine?
Asparagus and a small tossed salad with vinaigrette.
Any appetizer?
No, just the dinner. My mother thinks they ruin the appetite.
So, your mother cooked the veal medallions?
No, the maid.
Oh, the maid. And what was your mother doing?
She was with my father.
So, the maid cooked the dinner? And, I suppose, served it.
That's right.
And you dined alone?
Yes.
At a vast, highly polished mahogany table, I suppose.
That's right.
With a crystal chandelier?
Yes.
Really?
Yes.
Did you have music in the background?
Yes.
Mozart, I suppose, to go with the table and the chandelier?
No, Telemann.
And then?
I listened to Telemann for 20 minutes. He's one of my father's favorites. When the piece ended, I called my father.
And where was he, if you don't mind my asking?
He's in Sloane Kettering Hospital with lung cancer, and my mother is with him all the time because he's expected to die.
Oh, Daniel, I'm sorry. You should have told me instead of letting me put you through the dinner interrogation.
It doesn't matter. He's going to die anyway.
It was quiet in the classroom. What could I say now to Daniel? I'd played my little game, clever and amusing teacher-interrogator, and Daniel had been patient. Details of his elegant solitary dinner filled the classroom. His father was here. We waited by a bed with Daniel's mother. We'd remember forever the veal medallions, the maid, the chandelier, and Daniel alone at the polished mahogany table, while his father died. I tell my classes that on Mondays they should bring in the New York Times so that we can read Mimi Sheraton's restaurant reviews. They look at one another and shrug in the New York way. Raise your eyebrows. Lift your hands, palms out, elbows against your ribs. This shows patience, resignation, wonder.
Why are you asking us to read restaurant reviews? You might enjoy them, and of course broaden and deepen your vocabulary. That's what you're to tell important visitors from Japan and other places. Man, oh man, next you'll be asking us to bring in obituaries. That's a good idea, Myron. You could learn a lot from reading obituaries. Would you prefer that to Mimi Sheridan? You could bring in some juicy obituaries. Mr. McCourt, let's stick to recipes and restaurant reviews. Okay, Myron. We look into the structure of a Mimi Sheridan review. She gives us the ambience of the restaurant and the quality of service, or lack of it. She reports on each stage of a meal, appetizers, entrees, desserts, coffee, wine. She writes a summarizing final paragraph in which she justifies the stars she's awarding or not awarding. That is the structure. Yes, Barbara? I think this review is one of the meanest things I've ever read. I had this image of blood dripping from the paper in her typewriter or whatever she writes on. If you paid high prices in a restaurant like this, Barbara, wouldn't you like to be warned by someone like Mimi Sheridan? I tried to focus on the review, use of language, details, but they want to know if she eats out every night of her life and how does she do it. They said you'd have to feel sorry for someone with a job like that, where you can't just stay at home and have a hamburger or a bowl of cereal with a banana in it. She probably goes home nights and tells her husband she never wants to look at chicken or pork chops again in her life. The husband himself never has the pleasure of preparing a little collation to perk her up after a long day, as she's probably had enough food already to keep her going for a week. Imagine the dilemma of the husbands and wives of all these food critics. Husband can never invite wife out to dinner just for the sake of going out to dinner, where you don't have to glide things over your palate to figure out what spices were used or what was in the sauce. Who would want to eat with a woman who knows everything about food and wine? You'd be watching to see what kind of face she made at the first mouthful. No, she might have this glamorous job that pays loads of money, but you get tired of the same old routine of having to eat the best of everything. And can you imagine what it does to your insides anyway? Then, for the first time in my life, I used a word I'd never used before. I said, nevertheless, and repeated, nevertheless, I'm going to make Mimi Sheridans out of all of you. I asked them to write about the school cafeteria or neighborhood restaurants. No one wrote positive reviews of the school cafeteria. Three ended their essays with the same sentence, it sucks. There were rave reviews of local pizzerias and the vendor who sold hot dogs and pretzels on First Avenue. One pizzeria proprietor told students he'd like to meet me and thank me for calling attention to his business and bringing honor to his profession. It was a hell of a thing to think of this teacher with an Irish name encouraging his students to appreciate the finer things in life. Anytime I wanted a pizza, not just a slice but a whole one, the door was wide open, and I could have on that pizza anything I wanted, even if he had to send out to a delicatessen for extra toppings he might not have. I challenged them on the smugness and meanness of their school cafeteria reviews. All right, I said. The ambience is bleak. Mimi would agree with you. The cafeteria could be mistaken for a subway station or an army mess hall. You complain about the service. The women dishing out the food are too brusque. They don't smile enough. Ah, gee, that hurts your feelings. They simply dump the food, whatever it is, on a tray. Well, what do you expect? Put yourself into some dead-end job, and we'll see if you come out smiling. I tell myself, stop! No preaching. You did that years ago with your rant in the French Revolution. If they want to say it sucks, let them. Isn't this a free country? I ask them what they mean when they say the food sucks. You're writers. How about raising the level of your vocabulary? What would Mimi say? Oh, God, Mr. McCourt, does it have to be Mimi, Mimi every time we write about food? Well, what do you mean by it sucks? You know. What? Like you can't eat that stuff. Why not? Tastes like crap. Or it has no taste at all.